नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। This is a time of unexpected change. If we expect that things aren't going to change, then that's ignorance, because change is the fundamental law of all phenomena. All conditioned things are subject to change. They arise, they last for a while, and then they end. And in their ending, there is peace. But with our expectation of change, we don't see peace in the ending of things. We tend to experience the ending of things with dismay, concern, anxiety, sadness, or maybe gladness. But endings tend to involve gain and loss. And that's just the quality of the world. Two of the worldly winds, gain and loss. So how do we approach life without expecting? What kind of attitude of mind can we bring to the present moment, which will decrease our suffering? Because expectation increases it. What happens with expectation when we don't get what we want is disappointment. We were noticing after the storm in May how many trees were lost, how many homes were destroyed. We had no power. We were dysfunctional. But look at the storms in the human heart and how much destruction they cause. So if there's so much destruction around us all the time and we suffer over it, how do we hold ourselves together? How do we cope? How do we heal the rents that keep happening? I recently had this wound, and I learned that there are two kinds of healing. There's a first healing and a second healing, a first intention and a second intention. And those are medical names for healing. And I found that a very beautiful thing, that even the healing of the body has two dimensions to it. The first intention of healing is when there's a cut or a wound of some sort and you pull the skin together with a stitch or a band-aid. And the second intention is a granular healing from underneath. It's from within the body. There's a stitching together, a pulling together, a reuniting of the skin, of the system. And so around the wound, blood gathers, and all that inflammation is part of the healing process. In the mind, inflammation doesn't represent healing, actually. But we ourselves can heal internally first. Our first intention, you could call it right view. is you see the wound and you know there's a wound. You know there's damage inside. And you might gloss over it and you might make peace with it by continuing to function, to operate with that knowledge that there is some hurt, there's some suffering within, but you limp along. And right view is knowing the truth of things, understanding the truth of things. This is just the very first pillar of the path. But when we move to the second intention, then we're at right intention. That's when right view and right intention are paired. And that's when we begin to apply from within a healing. It's not just knowing there's a severance or knowing there's a cut, knowing there's a wound, knowing there's ignorance. But with right intention, we are beginning to apply the ways of healing the mind by letting go of our unwholesome thoughts and continuing the right view until there is an actual healing of the mind taking place. So that second layer of healing, that second intention, healing, which is granular, which is from the tissue itself, is coming from the inner connections within the mind, where we start to have right ways of thinking, right ways of directing the mind, right ways of processing information, processing life events, responding rather than reacting, responding wisely, compassionately, mindfully, kindfully, responding. And the results of right view and right intention working together in these ways are an actual wholeness happening in the heart, where we raise up courage, we raise up the ability to face what we have to face, whatever it is. So the Noble Eightfold Path begins with right view and right intention, but it also proceeds with those two factors continuously functioning so that we have healing from above and healing from below, healing from the outside and healing internally from within. Our meditation practice is a way of bearing fruit for right view and right intention, because every moment of mindfulness, every moment of staying with the object of our meditation practice and knowing its true ultimate characteristics is applying right view and right intention. So right view is holding the object, touching the object, knowing the object from within, because it's an internal examination where we see the true characteristics of it. Those are the wisdom factors. Then we are applying right effort, so sama vayama, and then sama sati and sama samadhi. And sama sati, of course, is knowing the object correctly. The wisdom of right intention is turned into a mindfulness where we penetrate the object wisely and we know its true ultimate characteristics. And then the mind comes to stillness. It becomes quiet. When the mind is quiet enough, then truth rolls in. That's the healing. Samadhi is the healing. Samadhi, wisdom, and right action, right speech, and right livelihood work together to meld our experience into a waking up. We're sitting with the body completely restrained. We're not getting up and sitting down. We're just sitting. We're not fumbling and fidgeting. We're sitting still. Then the stillness of the mind is healing. The inner workings of the mind settle. The mind stops fabricating. It stops fermenting. It stops going outwards, wandering outwards into thoughts, imaginations, and distractions. And it stays within itself. It goes to its own center. So when we touch that inner space, it's an interior knowing. We wake up. We experience the fruits of the practice. That right action starts from the inward stilling of the mind and of all mental formations to the understanding of that interior knowing. It's soundless, but it's a healing, a wholeness. And in the quiet, in the silence of that, all sound is contained. That knowing mind contains the whole universe. Where does all the universe begin? Anyway, it begins in the mind. Everything that is in this world has come from the human mind. Even the tallest skyscraper, the rocket ships, the great telescopes that are circling. Where were they first visualized? But inside the human mind. So that's the silence, the unspoken, that is speaking volumes. It speaks galaxies. Everything and nothing at once. And then in that healing process, we are practicing right livelihood. Right livelihood means, what is the right way of spending our time? What is the most fruitful way of being? It is this Eightfold Noble Path. So that's the fulfillment of all the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path in one breath, in one moment of right mindfulness. Right seeing, right knowing. And through that, there is right healing. Even if the body is dying, but the mind is liberated, there isn't a problem. There is no expectation. We're in the present moment, and we see the impermanence happening within us, right there in front of our eyes. In our own body-mind, we see the arising and ceasing. We see the cessation. And in the cessation, in the ceasing of the body itself, there is peace. That's why when a being passes away and we sit with that person and we see them in death, we see a face that is completely at peace. When someone dies well, because there is that peace of cessation. So much for us to learn by contemplating these ways of healing, the external healing, the internal healing. The first intention, which is more superficial, and the second intention, which brings all these factors together so that we are healed internally, completely. We become whole. The kilesas are overcome in this healing. The mind is no longer riddled with past and future, with attachments and identification to self. It's free. Totally free, totally whole, healed. The Buddha was perhaps the greatest doctor of all. He understood illness. He was very compassionate, being able to understand minutiae of human suffering, so that we, living in the monastery, following 311 precepts, we begin to notice from the way the Buddha formulated these precepts how intensely compassionate he was, how much he provided for us, even in these powerful ways of renunciation that we follow. There's so much compassion, understanding the difficulties that people would experience on a path of monastic renunciation. Yes, we fast, but then when you're sick, there are allowances. When you're hungry, there are allowances, but we still fast. So within a framework of restraint, you can still move. You can still be compassionate. You can forgive conditions. You can be strong within restraint. But there must be restraint. There must be discipline. That's discipleship. Discipleship means that we take on certain formulae with which to practice. So we can't bargain with precepts. If we're bargaining with precepts, then it becomes like a business. And Dhamma is not a business. It's a sacrifice. It's a making sacred. And the healing comes through giving up. It's maybe hard to understand because the world is taunting and coaxing the human mind to always acquire and to get, not to give up. So how can we become whole? How can we truly heal when we're caught by worldly messages which demand a lot of getting? Get this, get that. Get more. Don't give up. Nowadays, how difficult for children to give up their cell phones. How difficult it is to even talk to the parents about teaching the children to give up the cell phones. They don't want to hear it because it's become such an addiction. When their cell phone is absent, they become catatonic. They go into a kind of daze. They freeze. They become distracted and disassociated from the present moment totally. This was described to me. I was really shocked and saddened to hear this. Does the world take responsibility for this kind of sickness arising due to our human ignorance? No. How on earth, if our contemporary generation is suffering this level of addiction, how will human beings mature and ripen? How will the Dhamma ever survive in people who become so limited as kids? We must restrict ourselves in the usage of things. Otherwise, these objects begin to own us. How will we ever contemplate ownerlessness if we are slaves to the objects of the world? Our enslavement is already such a compromise. We cannot afford more compromise on that level. We really can't. And we see that from the environment. But look at the environment of the mind. It is also being badly affected by ignorant ways. So we try to influence each other and encourage each other to give up these things of the world that seem so compelling. Otherwise, we will get ourselves into a rabbit hole and be unable to liberate ourselves from it. And the ultimate healing is through liberation of the mind. It can never come from any computer. There will never be a robot that can free us. Ultimately, all of us want to be healed, not just bodily, because the body could be in perfect health and we could still be steeped in misery. So if we really take refuge in the Buddha, we have to trust that what the Buddha is telling us is not up for bargaining. We shouldn't be trying to compromise any of it. It's a very compassionate package. Though the Buddha was fully free himself, he spent 45 years trying to pass this teaching on to others, to help free them purely out of great compassion. So there's no cutting corners with this. We have to do the work. We have to devote ourselves to this work. Otherwise, we don't get the full healing. And it is within our reach. So those are just a few thoughts for tonight.